Good morning, everyone. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Presenting Homelessness Division to order. The CLA will take the roll to determine which members are present. The chair is present.
Keeler. New Brinley.
Present.
New Brinley present. Davids. Davids?
Present.
Davids present. Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Hollins. Hornstein. Howard. Cagle. Petersburg.
Present.
Petersburg present. Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. And we do have a quorum.
Thank you so much. So I'm really pleased to see especially that a number of GOP members made it to this special meeting on a Friday outside of our normally scheduled time for this really important conversation. This is an informational hearing. We're not going to take any formal action or anything today. We're going to hear from the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness about an overview of the ways that the state funds homelessness related activities. And, you know, as we've kind of discussed in this committee, this part of the issue is complicated, and this is going to be an ongoing body of work for us, I think, just in sort of trying to figure out the ways that the state is passing funding through to other entities, the ways that the state is contributing to this effort from our general fund, and, you know, to ensure that the way that we're spending these public resources is really meeting the needs of the populations that we're trying to serve. And so, you know, there's been great interest in this topic from the GOP lead. And so I'm really thankful that you all were able to make it tonight or today. And, you know, we're gonna have a lot of time for questions and conversation. And again, we're just sort of considering this like kind of a first bite at this, knowing that we're going to have to continue to dig into the programs that we have to discover what's working and not working, where those gaps are, what more we can do to meet people's needs. So with that, I'm going to, and I also just wanted to say like that, you know, Kathy Tenbrook and Eric Grumdahl put a lot of effort into making sure that we have all the folks who we need from the various programs on this call today. I'm really appreciative of all that work. And so we're gonna have a lot of time to dig into it, and I'm gonna turn it over to them now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Thank you, members. My name again is Eric Grumdahl with the Interagency Council on Homelessness. And I'm joined today by a large number of staff from a variety of agencies that have some of the programs that we'll cover and summarize today. And so just, I guess, would convey the same thanks, Chair Gomez, that you just relayed to all the staff from all the agencies that not only are with us right now, but also help compile the information that we're gonna share. This is, I think, the first time this kind of information has been compiled kind of across so many agencies and kind of organized in the way that we're hoping to share with you today. And so certainly appreciate that that I think one of the things that's apparent from that exercise is really the way in which homelessness not only cuts across a number of different agency budgets, but even within specific programs, just the complexity of being able to isolate the right set of expenses and costs and supports that should be included when we're trying to describe homelessness. So I'll spend quite a bit of time at the front end, just trying to be really clear about how we've thought about scope, given how complex and slippery some of those concepts can be. And we'll be inviting colleagues from the Interagency Council and the the agencies, especially DHS and Minnesota Housing and the Department of Public Safety to comment and help kind of fill in the picture and respond to questions when we get to that. The other piece that I would just say by way of framing is that there is a lot of complexity that we're going to walk through, and frankly, the number of individual kind of funding streams or programs that are covered in what we've put together is even larger right now, given the specific infusions in homeless response that have come as part of the pandemic response. And so both at a federal and a state level, some programs that appear on the list today that wouldn't have been 2 years ago. And so kind of that adds a whole nother layer that we're hoping to tease apart. I think the other thing that we're really hoping is that in sharing the way that there are all these different pieces and how they interrelate and work together, that we're really able to also give you a little bit of the history and context for how these programs originated. And I think, you know, maybe there is a temptation when looking at the complexity to think about the complexity itself as being problematic. And paraphrasing H.L. Mencken, I guess I'll say that for every complex solution, for every complex problem, there is a simple solution that does not work. And so I think that part of what you see across the range of responses here are that individual agencies and the areas that they're responsible for may have pieces of the solution that are deployed. And really what we hope at the Interagency Council level and really through this presentation is to convey kind of the ways in which those purposes and focuses of those programs really are intended to work together and support one another. I think the other thing to share is that really this system, if you will, I don't know if that's the right term of art, but if this set of programs anyway, has emerged really fairly organically over the course of many years through rounds of successful advocacy to really address unmet needs that communities were bringing forward and that the legislature acted on. And Congress, so both state and federal action to address kind of those gaps. And so in some ways we can liken it less to a Swiss watch that was designed intricately upfront to make everything work just the way that it should and have all the parts that were needed to be able to achieve the function of that system, and instead more to a levee that has been built kind of successively as there have been problems that have not been addressed by previous efforts. And so it's almost sedimentary layers of trying to patch problems that have not been addressed by the resources that existed previously. And it has really largely been community advocacy efforts that have brought forward kind of those specific solutions and options that have kind of added to the overall landscape of the programs that we'll cover. I'll go to the next slide here. There we go. Go ahead, Chair Gomez.
Sorry, just Mr. Grumdahl, quickly. I just saw that Representative New Brindley had her hand up. I don't know if there was something just kind of before we dig into the meat of the presentation, if you wanted to ask Representative.
That's exactly right, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity. And first of all, I know, Mr. Grumdahl, you asked about advancing slides. I don't know if you intend for something to be shared for us, but there's no slides shared with us right now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, but my other question, Madam Chair, I'm wondering, this is sort of the presentation we've been waiting for. We really need to dig in to the finances of this and understand the funding mechanisms. I noticed there's very few members of the majority on the call. Are you expecting more members to arrive? I think this is probably one of the most critical hearings we've had. So we would hope that folks would be here for this.
Representative New Brindley, yeah, thanks for asking. Representative Keeler has joined us. I know that we are expecting Representative Hornstein in just a few minutes, and Representative Cagle has another engagement. So we're kind of we're rounding people up and hoping that Representatives Hollins and Howard are able to join us, but we'll have a couple more members on in the next few minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And Chair Gomez and Representative New Brindley, let me just confirm that you are able to see the slides now. Is that correct?
Yes. Great.
Thank you. Thanks for flagging that. So the next piece we just wanted to cover by way of kind of framing up the information that we'll share is that we are really focused in the summary document that you've received, I believe, and the information that we'll present in really looking at the resources, the investments made by taxpayers to respond to homelessness in a variety of different programs. And that is certainly a critical, important topic and part of the picture. We also want to just emphasize, I guess, the point that understanding really the value or the impact of those investments is really a separate conversation from just looking at the investments themselves. And so I just want to name the fact that there is a whole nother set of discussions we could have really around the impact of specific programs and how those programs are kind of achieving the results that they're achieving. And just as an example of that, you know, when we talk about the investments that have been made in the pandemic response, which are significant, I think it's important to understand the information that's on the screen now in front of you, which we shared at a previous hearing, around the ways in which those investments have really helped protect people experiencing homelessness from much worse outcomes that we might have seen, not only for that population, but for communities as a whole in Minnesota from what we had kind of initially modeled as potential transmission rates and infection rates and hospitalizations for people experiencing homelessness. So the fact that those investments have not only created important outputs of additional shelter capacity and allowed shelters to adapt and retool their response in the midst of the pandemic to work more effectively in the context of COVID-19. We've also seen that has then in turn translated to much better results in terms of outbreak management and just overall mitigating disease transmission than we might have otherwise expected. And so happy at some point to go into kind of more of those outcomes across these programs in whatever way would be helpful, and certainly where there are opportunities to do so, we're happy to do so as well. So the first challenge in defining what programs would be included in this analysis, we've attempted to depict in this Venn diagram. And so trying to give you a sense of where we've focused and not. And so there are three circles here, the light blue circle, and these are not scaled in any way other than just for convenience. The light circle, light blue circle is really the range of programs that support people experiencing homelessness. And that's a fairly broad range of programs, as you could imagine. A subset of which are actually programs that in some sense or for some portion of the program requires eligibility, homelessness as an eligibility criteria. So you get the program because you are homeless, not just if you are homeless. And then in the green circle, the range of programs that exist that are focused in some way on housing or shelter or some other related service that's in some way about creating housing stability for people that need that support. And so we have tried as best as possible to focus on the intersection of those circles. There are some programs that it's not straightforward or easily feasible without getting into a much deeper data analysis to distinguish the services that are going to somebody who's experiencing homelessness versus somebody who's at risk of homelessness, for example. So we have a little bit of that target in red there, extending into the green area as well. So just want to name that's an important consideration as we think about these programs and what we've been able to summarize here. And we thought it might just be helpful to illustrate some examples of what falls in each spot of this Venn diagram, just to give you a little bit of a flavor. And so in that center intersecting circle where we've tried to focus primarily for today, you know, that includes programs like the Emergency Services Program, which really provides direct support from DHS to nonprofits focused on providing a range of services and covering operating costs to have emergency shelter capacity available, to have the staffing that are available to provide emergency shelter services. That's kind of a classic example of something that would be right in the center of that bullseye. Programs that are also kind of focused on people experiencing homelessness, but are not necessarily about housing or shelter. An example of that would be the Federal Education for Homeless Youth and Children, Homeless Children and Youth Program, which is federally administered out of the U.S. Department of Education. And it's really focused on supporting the school district homeless liaisons in their work, making sure that homeless students are connected with the various supports and entitlements that they're eligible to receive on the basis of their homelessness, which are really focused on maintaining school stability and keeping kids connected and successful in their school experience. In that outer band is actually a large number of really important programs that we know play critical roles for people experiencing homelessness, but again, are not targeting people experiencing homelessness exclusively and are not necessarily focused on housing or shelter specifically. So that could be everything from medical assistance to emergency assistance, a whole range of programs that are providing important and critical supports to people experiencing homelessness, but don't require homelessness in order to be eligible for the program and may not be specifically focused on housing or shelter. Then finally, the last kind of area of this Venn diagram to highlight is the area that's focused on housing, but may not be focused on homelessness in any way. And that includes a range of mainstream housing programs. It includes, you know, resources like the mortgage interest deduction you could include in that category. It includes things like the COVID housing assistance program administered by Minnesota Housing with the federal coronavirus relief funds. And so we're hoping that just being able to kind of name this landscape and the complexity here and really where we've tried to focus is helpful as we go forward. I think another piece that will be important to just understand and recognize is that for many of these programs, the purposes that they've been defined to serve, either legislatively or by Congress, whatever vehicle they've been defined to serve, specific components of a homeless response, but very few, if any of them, actually serve the entire landscape of what might be needed for an individual organization or program to support somebody experiencing homelessness. Or it depends, I guess, there's a relationship between what a specific organization or program is trying to deliver and what different kinds of funding sources they might need. And so just to appreciate as we go into this, that really understanding the distinction and the variation in the purposes that our various programs can serve helps you kind of see how these pieces fit together and where they fit together. And so, you know, one way that we often summarize those purposes across a lot more detail underneath it is to think about supports that are focused on housing or shelter. And an example of that might be rental assistance. Supports that are really focused on services. That could be staff that are providing some kind of case management or referral or linkage or assessment support to help connect people with the right kinds of care. And operating expenses, which are, you know, often for programs to cover basic daily operating costs that aren't squarely services and aren't squarely covered in things like rental assistance programs. So a front desk operating at a supportive housing program, for example, those costs are often thought of as operating costs. And so depending on what program we're talking about specifically that an organization might be trying to implement, they might need some combination of these different components covered. And so then it's kind of piecing together the right funding streams that are responsive to those purposes. The next piece we just want to be really explicit about is that there are a lot of different actors that have, you know, kind of in this levy metaphor that I use, that have stepped forward and kind of identified resources that they can contribute. We have really focused in our summary of the funds that go through state government. And so funds that we receive from the federal government, funds that go from the state government to tribal, county, or municipal governments, and funds that go directly from the state government to homeless service organizations. It's important to note, only a subset of the total landscape. And so, you know, we're aware of fund flows in these dotted lines that exist in all of that are relating these different entities. Often we don't have data to be able to point to those investments. We believe that the state investments in Minnesota's homeless response represent the majority of those dollars overall, But again, doing a full accounting of all of this would be a much larger research project that would involve a lot of other partners in being able to document and understand. Similarly, we have not in this analysis quantified or described philanthropic investments, which again, I think, you know, even understanding that landscape, that is a rich and vast landscape as well, much of which, you know, kind of would mirror the other fund flows that you see here, philanthropic relationships with almost all of these other entities. So just to appreciate that we have focused here on the solid blue lines in depicting funds that flow through state government. This is a list again, just of the interagency council member agencies, just as a reminder. And the programs that we're summarizing today come from four agencies. So the programs that fit those criteria that we just walked through are programs that are operated by the Department of Human Services, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and Minnesota Housing. And so those are the programs that we're really focused on for today's discussion.
Mr. Grumdahl?
Yes, please.
Just if we could pause for a moment, I just wanted to make sure that, just to check and see if any members had questions kind of about that sort of grounding information that Mr. Grumdahl shared with us about kind of the way that he's going to go through this. I don't see any, but Representative Petersburg, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is just in regards to, you know, earlier in your discussion, you talked about all these agencies and organizations that were all dealing kind of with different aspects of homelessness. And I would kind of relate it to, you know, kind of an illness where we have a cold or something. We may have runny nose and we have fever. And it's kind of like we're all dealing with each one of those little things, but we haven't really dealt with how do we prevent the cold to begin with. And my question is, have there been any studies or ideas on how we catch people before they become homeless? Because all of these programs that have funding are dealing with after the fact, when they are already homeless, and we're trying to help them kind of recover in each of those different aspects rather than the totalitary issues of why they became homeless and what we do to catch people before they become homeless. Is there any information in that regard?
I just, real quickly, I guess I appreciate that question. I wanted to share kind of like the context for this conversation today maybe is like, I guess in my mind, when I think of, this is sort of one of the, you're identifying one of the really hard things I think about this division, right? Preventing homelessness, because like as we kind of dug into this issue. And as you think about it, you know, there's so many factors that go into kind of getting to the place where they're experiencing homelessness. So I just kind of imagine, even just as engaging in a thought exercise, that it would be incredibly difficult to account for all those things and all those public investments that do, you know, contribute to stabilizing families and stabilizing people in their housing so that they don't get to the point of becoming homeless. But your question, Representative Petersburg, also speaks to the, you know, the something that we've discussed a couple times, which is the difficulty in accounting for the cost of inaction or the difficulty in accounting for the externalities of decisions that we do and don't make in various kind of parts of our budget. So I really appreciate that. And I appreciate the way that you are continuing to help us to kind of orient ourselves to our mission, right, which is in our title. And then I wanted, if Mr. Grumdahl, if you have any thoughts, I would love to hear them. Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Representative Petersburg. I think to that question, as I think we shared it in previous testimony, when we really think about what it means to prevent and end homelessness, part of that is about finding ways to reduce the number of incidents that occur in the first place. That's a really critical part of that overall response. And in addition, making sure that when people are stably housed after their experience of homelessness, that housing really remains stable, that they have the supports necessary to to not kind of cycle back into an experience of homelessness. And so we really do see that being a really important part of the overall picture. Being able to really describe what resources exist that are really effectively preventing homelessness or are used to help stabilize people before they're facing that crisis takes us kind of out into those other circles of the Venn diagram in some really important ways. And so I think that could be something that you know, we'd be happy to get into and explore more fully. So I think today you're right that the focus is really really on the response for people who are experiencing homelessness, but fully concur that being able to see that broader landscape is also important. And I will invite anybody else on from the state team, if they have anything else they'd want to add to that response, to do so.
Did anybody else from an agency want to chime in on that question? I don't hear anybody. Representative Petersburg?
Thank you. I don't want to underestimate the value of the programs that we have in place. That's not my question at all. But it seems to me that it would be helpful for us to have some sort of analysis or some sort of understanding of some of the issues that led to homelessness to find out whether or not there is a trend or a particular theme that has led to that, because then that would allow us to go back and find those triggers and be able to help people through that before they experience the homelessness. It's just one of my thoughts is that we kind of need to find out some of the corresponding similarities that may exist, and maybe they don't, but unless we ask the question, we don't. Thank you for the allowing me to ask that question. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you so much, Representative Petersburg. Were there any other members who had questions at this point, or should we have Mr. Grumdahl go ahead? Not seeing any questions, so maybe let's move ahead with the next slide, Mr. Grumdahl.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. The next slide I wanted to pull up is just the overall summary of the written information that you've received. So what the table that's in the body of the document that you've received represents is 23 programs from 4 different agencies, as we spoke about a moment ago. We've included the totals by fiscal year, including the proposed increases in the governor's budget, which we'll get into in just a minute. I think it's really important to emphasize how much this overall picture has been impacted and enhanced in the context of the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And so one way to think about that financially is to say that for the current and previous fiscal year, it was $93.8 million in state and federal resources that passed through state government that kind of would fall on this targeted list of responses to homelessness. And so those investments are ones that are not anticipated to be ongoing or to be continued. And so I think it makes the point about the way in which over the last year, as part of the response to the pandemic, the homeless system has expanded substantially to help address some of the needs and requirements of operating in the context of the pandemic, and to be, again, protecting people experiencing homelessness and their communities as part of that response. I guess the other piece that comes with that is to quickly emphasize that even with that one-time increase, I think we're all aware that there remain significant unmet needs in homelessness. And so this kind of a one-time infusion of resources was really critical in terms of standing up some of those pandemic responses, but has not kind of solved homelessness in any sense. Those investments were really targeting the specific solutions needed to protect people from COVID-19, including standing up additional spaces for people to recover when they contracted COVID and didn't have a safe place to go, but didn't need to be in the hospital. You know, those kinds of things that have been critical in the overall response, but aren't expected to be resources that are available on an ongoing basis. We did want to just very quickly summarize the investments that are proposed in the governor's budget on homelessness. So a $10 million increase in the emergency services program, a $10 million increase in the community living infrastructure grants program. And really, you can think of those programs as being kind of the core parts of the state's investment in the response to homelessness in many ways of being able to stand up and operate critical outreach services and shelter supports and also being able to help connect with the community living infrastructure grants, helping to connect people experiencing homelessness to county human service systems that can address a range of other issues that may be confronting somebody and contributing to their housing instability. There's $1 million base funding proposal for the homeless management information system, which has really been a critical tool for us to be able to understand the dynamics and evolving kind of needs related to homelessness. $6.3 million for expanding the work to prevent and end veteran homelessness. As I think we touched on in a previous hearing, there's been really remarkable progress in Minnesota on veteran homelessness. And so really the governor and MDVA and the Interagency Council have made the continued focus on reaching the goal of ending veteran homelessness statewide. We are making significant progress there, and these investments would help to sustain that. $1 million increase for the Homework Starts with Home program, which is a partnership between the Interagency Council, Minnesota Housing, and the Minnesota Department of Education, along with community collaborations that are really focused on supporting homeless students and connecting them with and their families with the resources needed to stabilize in housing, but also to make sure that they've got the other supports in their school and their kind of county human service system connected to them as well. $4 million for the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program, which often, I think, to Representative Petersburg's question earlier, often end up also supporting people who are experiencing some kind of housing crisis before they've confronted homelessness. And so that's one of those really critical prevention investments. $500,000 for Bridges, and then the Bridges Rental Assistance Program, which is really helping to stabilize people experiencing mental illness and connect them with a housing option that is community-based and helping to sustain stable housing for that population. And then $100 million for housing infrastructure bonds, which is really one of the state's key tools and vehicles for fueling the development and creation of affordable and supportive housing. I see there's a question. Maybe before we open that up to that, I just want to invite if my state agency colleagues have anything else they'd want to add about the governor's budget proposal that I didn't cover. All right, hearing none.
All right, Representative New Brindley, do you have a question before we move on?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I appreciate the conversation that we're allowed to just interact and engage throughout the presentation. That's really helpful with this. I'm wondering if you can tell me more, first of all, about the homeless management information system. What is tracked with that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative New Brindley. The Homeless Management Information System is a federally mandated system operated in Minnesota as a partnership between state government and local continuum of care regions. So Minnesota is divided into 10 continuum of care regions that operate collaboratively in applying for federal resources that they receive directly that do not pass through state government. They're required to have, by HUD, to have a homeless management information system that is really intended to make sure that we understand the dynamics of homelessness across the country. It's a federal mandate. But in Minnesota, we also use that as the platform then to build on similar reporting that we do for state programs, so that when a state program is focused on people experiencing homelessness, rather than have those same nonprofits or other grantees have to use a separate system to report on what's happening with those programs, they use the same federal system. It's a system that is mainly focused on really following the entry and exit of people into and out of various programs so that we were able to actually see kind of progress toward housing stability over time. And I would say that it's as a collaborative and as a partnership among a lot of different jurisdictions, local and state and federal, it's been kind of a place of a lot of evolution and development to try to have it be the most effective tool that it can be. It's also being used right now for in ways that I think are really powerful and helpful in terms of just even understanding what's been the impact for homeless populations in the COVID pandemic. And so being able to also support some really critical research projects that are not the daily operating work of the system, but are helpful in terms of just illuminating different dimensions of the response to homelessness. And again, I just open it up if any of my state colleagues have anything else they'd want to add to that answer.
Can I ask a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yeah, of course. I don't hear anything from any other state agency that wants to add about HMIS. Yeah, please go ahead, Rep.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's actually interesting. So it's a federal program. I'm wondering how much flexibility we have in the state of Minnesota to use that system in ways that we see beneficial. You know, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure that there are certain things that are mandated in that system. How prescriptive is that? And do we have flexibility at the state level to really adjust whether it is the metrics, what kind of data we're collecting, whatever it might be? How much flexibility do we have at the state level?
Representative Gomez and Representative Brindley, the system is largely one that can adapt to changing program requirements. And when a state program defines what it's going to collect in HMIS, it has a fairly broad latitude in being able to say, here are the things that we're interested in tracking for the policy or program purposes that this program is intending to serve. That's often done with reference to what already exists in the system, because it'll be more straightforward to kind of build it connected to some of the requirements that already exist. So if you're collecting somebody's name or other identifiers in a certain way, it's often easier to just kind of piggyback on that approach rather than develop a separate or parallel approach. The other thing I'd add is that the federal requirements tend to be fairly minimal. And so that gives some basic, there's a set of data elements that are collected in the system called universal data elements that are intended to be collected for everybody in there. Those are really intended to be the bare bones, most minimal set of information. And then programs kind of build their specific additional data elements that they want to collect on top of that. And there's a lot of flexibility in kind of developing how programs do that additional data collection and reporting.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Grumdahl. I really appreciate that. That's really interesting. My only other question, you know, I know on the earlier slide, we really narrowed the scope of who we're talking about. And so I'm wondering if you have a number on how many people these programs are serving.
Chair Grumdahl.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Representative Brindley. The population served by each program varies a bit because the programs themselves, of course, will define who's eligible for that program. And so it's a complicated question, I guess, to answer. And it's kind of beyond in some ways what we've put together for today's presentation. What I will say overall is that, you know, the overall population of Minnesotans experiencing homelessness at a point in time, we know is at least 8,000 people based on that annual point in time count that occurs every January. And we don't have the results from just the one that occurred this past January, last month, but from the 2020 point in time count, that's our understanding. We know that's a minimum estimate. That's the number of people we confirmed on a single night were experiencing homelessness. They were in shelter, they were in transitional housing, or they were outdoors. And so we know the actual number is something above that. But it gives us at least a flavor of how big that universe is. Some of these programs do, of course, support populations that are not experiencing homelessness. And so those would be a larger number of people or who might be at risk of homelessness. And so that's where I think we get into a lot of the complexity. I'd open it up if my state colleagues have anything else they'd want to add to that answer, but happy to come back with some additional information about that if that'd be helpful. It is a very weedy question.
Thank you.
Representative New Brindley, did you have any other questions now?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. I just wanted to make kind of, a comment slash question on that last point that Representative New Brindley asked about. Because the other thing I wonder about is like if some of the programs, you know, I mean, I'm sure that each of the programs sort of individually maintains an accounting of the number of people that they serve over a year or whatever, over a biennium. But I wonder to what extent there's sort of like, I assume programs, multiple programs are used to serve a single individual. And I'm kind of interested in this, in whether the HMIS can give us maybe sort of more of a picture of that. And that's maybe sort of a kind of future question. But I know that Representative Keeler has brought up kind of concerns about how much we rely on the single day point in time count. And it's interesting to me, kind of, you know, I think about the, for example, this, the Department of Corrections presentation, or, you know, some of the data that I've heard about students experiencing homelessness. And it's weird because it feels like it's really hard to even get our arms around like that simple question that Representative New just asked, which is like, how many people are being served by our programs in a year? I feel like a lot of these questions sort of reveal the underlying complexity, which is sort of what we're digging into, but that's maybe more of a comment. I know that Representative Hornstein has a question also.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Grumdahl, for this excellent presentation. You know, we've been talking a lot in our committee about wraparound services. And so, you know, I see a lot here for that. And I'm just thinking about, you know, if I'm communicating with my constituents who have a lot of concern, I mean, this is a very high priority in the area I represent. Would it be fair to say that all of these items in the governor's budget, with the possible exception in terms of direct funding, the homelessness management information system. I mean, of course, that does have some interface, of course, with wraparound services. But it would seem to me, and I did, you know, a quick addition here, if you take away that 1 million, then I would say, would it be fair to say you have $131.8 million, you know, going towards programs that include wraparound services? Would that be a fair one sentence description of this budget?
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Representative Hornstein. I don't know that I would describe all of these investments as kind of including or providing wraparound services. I think that in terms of providing some part of the homeless response, that's certainly the case. They play various roles. And so just to pick an example, you know, I think the focus of the housing infrastructure bonds is really to incent and create opportunities for affordable housing development that the market would not otherwise create. And so I don't know that I would characterize that as a wraparound service option. It certainly creates a platform in affordable housing or supportive housing where wraparound services get delivered. And so I think that's an important ingredient. So I hope that answer is helpful, Representative Hornstein.
Yeah, it is. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Mr. Grumdahl. I just, you know, it piqued my question when I looked at the fourth bullet point and you talked about support and expand veterans' homeless efforts, including housing vouchers and wraparound services. Again, that was made clear in your narrative. But, you know, drop-ins, you know, the emergency service programs, it seems, has that. Community living infrastructure grants have that. So, you know, maybe we're getting into sort of some nuances here. But I really do feel that, and I've spoken about this in the committee before, that model is one that we should strive for and try to recreate, you know, around the state. So, again, we can we can talk more offline about this, but you know, I do think it would be an important thing to highlight as you are messaging this, you know, important level of funding, particularly infrastructure bonds. You know, I think that's an important piece to highlight and maybe, you know, talk about in perhaps a little more depth.
Thank you, Representative. I saw that Representative Petersburg had a question, and then Representative Heinrich, you're on deck. Go ahead, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so this question kind of gets back to the same thing about budget. And I understand that we have a minimum of 8,000 people that are homeless. Even if we go to 10,000, which makes it a little easier, at $130 million, we're talking about $13,000 piece just for the governor's budget, plus the other nonprofit organizations that are putting forth into that too. Has there ever been any consideration to look at, you know, where we are getting the best benefit for the dollars that we're doing, and how we can continue to use those as guidelines? Obviously, we want to be able to provide the most services that we can for the most people, and we know that there's always going to be a finite number of dollars available. So how do we kind of do the best for that? And it seems like we need to be looking at those figures, you know, what does it cost per person as well? And wondering if you have any more specifics to that, and whether or not that's something that's even tracked up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. I want to turn it over to Mr. Grumdahl. I wanted to just say that the we probably need to delve a little bit more into this, but the 8,000 or 10,000 number is a point in time count. So that's like on one day where there's a real concerted effort to go out and count everybody. But maybe Mr. Grumdahl can help us understand like how that relates to the number of people who we think experience homelessness like over a year, or if there's a way to kind of contextualize that number a little bit. Mr. Grumdahl?
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Representative Petersburg for the question. I think the point you made, Representative Gomez, about the churn or the kind of overall turnover we see in the number of people experiencing homelessness in a year is a much larger population. And so depending on, you know, I think we use the point in time count for some important purposes in ways that are comparable to other states across the country and overall national progress. But there are other data sources that we use as well. It's certainly not just the point in time count to help really give us the fullest, roundest picture we can of kind of what's happening with homelessness. And some of those other data sources can help us kind of understand what we see in terms of that overall volume. So looking at the number of entries and exits out of the homeless management information system over a period of time, for example, would be one of those ways to do that. Schools do a count that is both a point in time count in October, and then they look at how many students have been identified over the course of an entire school year. So there are a variety of ways like that that we're able to kind of tease out the overall size of that population and how that changes over time. And so we think of the point in time count in some ways as just helping us really monitor trends and also to be able to do so in comparison to other states across the country. The other piece that I would say just about these specific investments and kind of the relationship between the people served and the investments is that, of course, many of these investments serve multiple people, multiple individuals. So whether it's an intervention that's targeting a family and serving an entire family unit, or whether it's a housing unit that's been created with support from housing infrastructure bonds that will serve many people over the lifetime of its operation. I think it ends up again being a little bit more weedy in terms of really being able to drill into kind of the utilization of these services on a per person basis. And that's something that we can come back with the information that we have, or I'd invite state colleagues to comment on that now as well, to the extent that there's stuff folks would like to share. I think the larger question of kind of effectiveness and what do we see in terms of outcomes, I think that is exactly to the point of the comments I shared earlier in terms of really understanding not just the taxpayer investment, but the value or the return on that investment that we see in the context of outcomes. There have been certainly a variety of research studies. These are never easy research projects to undertake, because just even assembling the information needed to really do some accounting of this is not a small thing. But what we have seen is really tremendous output or outcomes in terms of the return on investment by being able to look at the differential changes in costs using crisis or emergency services, for example. And there's some emerging evidence that's really encouraging about for homeless children, for example, about the long-term kind of trajectory toward closing educational gaps of being able to get connected with stable housing. And so I would say there is a body of research that exists to really help us understand how responses to homelessness kind of have that kind of cost impact or outcomes that they achieve for the people that they serve. But it is rarely only in the homeless system. It's almost always in looking at the other systems that end up being impacted when somebody is housed instead of experiencing homelessness. So before I turn it back, maybe just let me give me an opportunity to see if my colleagues had anything else they wanted to add to that response. Feels like a very important question.
Oh, Madam Chair, can I just tack on one more question?
Oh, of course, please, Ms. Representative Petersburg, go ahead.
Along with that, you know, it does seem though that we should have information in regards to how many people are served in each particular program and the cost for that. Seems to me that would be something that would be easily to obtain. Am I correct here? And doesn't that help us kind of understand? I'm not here to judge the effectiveness of the program yet because I don't have that information. I mean, obviously that's why we're asking questions, but it seems to me we can understand from the type of service, how much is spent and the number of people, whether or not it's effective in its own right. And I realize we need to include all sorts of different things with it, but we have to do something in order to get a handle on, you know, what do we do or what don't we do? That was my question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Mr. Grumdahl?
Chair Gomez and Representative Petersburg, thanks again for the question. We would be happy to come back with additional information about who's served in each of these programs, and that'll be a deeper dive or another cut on this information, but happy to do so. And I think Assistant Commissioner Baumtrog might want to jump in from Minnesota Housing. So, Ryan?
Commissioner Baumtrog, hi, welcome to
the Chair Gomez, members of the committee. I'm Ryan Baumtrog, still assistant to the commissioner at Minnesota Housing. Wanted to jump in to the representative's question. Minnesota Housing, you know, as Mr. Grumdahl walks through some of the programs for Minnesota Housing, we have four general programs that are state appropriated in the agency's budget. Minnesota Housing, I'll just take a quick 1 minute detour if it works for the chair, just to talk about Minnesota Housing generally. We are a state agency that receives some state appropriations, just over about $100 million for the 2 year biennium, and around 50% of what the agency gets from state appropriations goes to the programs that Mr. Grumdahl has walked through and will walk through later in the presentation. So while Minnesota Housing, about 50% of the agency's appropriations are around housing stability programs, I just wanted to note that, you know, the agency is 0.3%, a third of a percent of the overall state budget. So just some overall context about, you know, Minnesota Housing's programs that focus on housing stability, those at really low incomes, mostly around homelessness prevention and rental assistance, are really small part of the overall state budget. We just this past week, as it relates to program results and program assessment, finalized our federal fiscal year 2020 program assessment, where for each program, we break down how much was spent by each program, what the median household income was, who was served by the program, and how much in assistance they received to achieve that housing stability for the previous year. So I will make sure that gets in the right hands to the committee, or whatever gets compiled after this hearing, we'll make sure that that's a part of it. I could also send along, there are numerous studies specifically on rental assistance, and we've done some of our own research at the agency, but also national studies about rental assistance and how rental housing stability through rental assistance helps parents earn more, helps them obviously maintain housing stability. In Homework Starts with Home, the program that's on the screen right now, where there's a $1 million increase, helps kids show up to school more and likely improves school performance. So there's a number of evidence-based studies around housing stability programs, particularly rental assistance, that we can share with the committee that really demonstrate the effectiveness, the cost effectiveness of housing stability and keeping people in their homes and limiting what they pay to about 30% of their income.
Thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner. I think when I worked at the city and we worked with the police department and the fire department a lot, we just called all the assistant chiefs and deputy chiefs chief. And so I think I do that with commissioners, and maybe it's not the right thing, so I'll try to get out of the habit of doing that.
Chair Gomez, I'm just always concerned that the commissioner's listening, and if I don't correct, then I'll get
We weren't demoting Commissioner Ho, if you're listening. My apologies. and Representative Petersburg, I'm really thankful for those questions. It sounds like I said, this is kind of our first bite at the apple, and I'm sort of anticipating, I hope folks are kind of taking notes. I think there's a lot of information that, that we need as a committee to continue to build this shared kind of foundational understanding of this issue so that we can figure out how to make good decisions about this area. So, we're going to continue this work, and I'm really appreciative of all the good questions and good conversation we're having today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Heinrich, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think parts of my questions were already answered, I guess, through Rep. Petersburg's line of questioning. And I just want to thank Mr. Grumdahl and the assistant commissioner. I don't know if it's the assistant to the commissioner or the assistant commissioner is correct there, but no. I understand that it's probably difficult to, extrapolate and unwind how this breaks down, but one thing, Mr. Grumdahl, that you had said about how we kind of have a metric, maybe a per pupil metric in the school system, just to kind of double down on Rep. Petersburg's comments. And like I said, I know it's tough to kind of unwind here and now, but just how important it is to make sure that we do end up with some sort of per homeless spending number. I mean, I think that would be helpful. How many people are being served overall from the programs? It'd be interesting to know the public and private breakdown. At the end of the day, how much per homeless person? I feel like we should have these numbers available. So I appreciate your comments today, and thank you for your work on this, and look forward to learning some more good information on this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. I don't see any further questions or comments at this time, so can move forward. I kind of am liking being able to sort of have this be more of a conversation. So if members can continue to raise their hands during the presentation, and we'll kind of find a good spot to stop and have conversation, that would be great. Go ahead, Mr. Grumbel. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thanks for this discussion as well. Really appreciate all the questions and interest. So just now kind of turning into more of the details and various ways that we've tried to summarize the very dense information presented in the document that you received. Here's just one way to look at that. And though just to orient us, what we've done is that for all of the following graphs that we'll share, the fiscal years are shown on a color gradient, these shades of blue from the darkest blue to the lightest blue. So the darkest blue being the oldest, the lightest blue being the governor's proposed budget for the next biennium. And so this is really just looking at those overall amounts that are presented in the table, but really breaking it down, looking at specific agencies. And so I think what you see here is, again, the way in which the investments really do span across a number of agencies, as we've shared, and also particularly with the DHS columns for the 2020 and 2021 fiscal years, that significant increase that we've seen really in those COVID specific funds that are included in the table. And so I think that helps to just show a sense of how much that additional investment represents in the context of the overall kind of ongoing investment that we would expect in the base, And then also, of course, gives you a sense of the governor's budget proposals and kind of how they relate to that that base funding amount. And so I'm hopeful that that at least shed some light on just how those amounts vary by agency. This next picture is looking at by the funding source. And so we've distinguished here the general funds that have been appropriated really specific to the pandemic response at the state level from ongoing general fund investments. And again, same color gradient here between the dark blue and the light blue from fiscal year 20 through the governor's budget proposal for the next biennium. And so, you know, I think when we think about that 93.8 million that was really one time or you know, pandemic specific investment, just how much that ends up representing in terms of the overall context. And also, I think this shows, at least for the funds that flow through state government, the proportionality between the investments that are federal in their origin and the ones that are that originate at the state.
Mr. Grumdahl, I just saw that Representative Ryer had a question. I don't know if it was about the previous slide, but just in case it was, because these are sort of dense. I just want to make sure if there's a specific question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Grumdahl. I love data, so you're making my morning. I just have a question. It came to me when I was looking at slide 9, because it's such a vivid depiction of the change from year to year. My question is, if you had 2019 on this slide, would they look more like the 22-23 base? Because I'm just looking for context of if, you know, we have the COVID specific in 20 and 21, but 2019 was just, we're kind of returning to that same level. Just looking for context.
Mr. Grumdahl.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Representative Ryer. I think qualitatively that is correct. I think some of these programs, it's important to note, are forecasted rather than budgeted. And so they really vary based on the number of enrollees, the number of people who are eligible for the program, which does vary from time to time. And so it wouldn't be an exact match to subsequent fiscal years, but I think in general, I think that's a qualitatively the right sense that they'd be very similar to the 2022-2023 base funding.
Representative Breyer?
Oh, that's perfect. I was asking it more of an order of magnitude level, and that answered my question completely. Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Grumdahl.
All right, thank you, Chair Gomez. And so then the last way that we just wanted to summarize the information that we know is really dense in the document that you received is, again, coming back to the point that we made at the beginning about the way in which the purposes that are served by these various investments vary. And it's really around each specific program or intervention that is responding to homelessness being able to identify the resources that are needed to operate that particular program. And so so here is one, this is a very simplified version of kind of collapsing some of the more detailed information that you see in the table in the document that you've received, but at least gives you a flavor for the range of investments that, you know, many programs actually do more than one of these components. And so the funds that are awarded to these specific purposes within any specific program may vary from one grantee to the next grantee, really based on what that grantee has requested. But I hope it gives you a sense of how these puzzle pieces really do fit together and interlock, and the way in which what's needed for a program operator who's trying to respond to the needs in front of them is access to the right combination of supports. And so this is how the state resources anyway break down in that way.
If, just a moment. Representative New Brindley had a question maybe about this slide.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious to know, and again, I know that I apologize if we keep asking the same question, but I'm hoping that maybe by narrowing the scope we'll know. I'm wondering if you know, I see rental assistance and services, and then rental assistance as separate sort of line items here. Does that mean that folks, is the pot of rental assistance folks who are not also receiving wraparound services? Or why is that broken up like it is?
Chair Grumdahl?
Chair Gomez and Representative New Brindley. So what we've done here in the table that you've received, each row identifies what are the allowable purposes or activities for that specific program. We've greatly simplified them into just these categories, but what you'll see in that more detailed description in the table is that a number of those programs actually serve multiple purposes. So they might provide some short-term rent assistance to help somebody rapidly restabilize in housing, and they might provide support for a case manager to be able to work with that person in identifying housing or addressing whatever issues might stand in the way of their ongoing stability. And so all we've done here is to simply add up the rows based on whether the programs are serving one or more purposes. And if they're serving multiple purposes, we've just called it, we've just concatenated whatever those purposes would be, right? And so this is not a more sophisticated analysis of looking at kind of how you would tease that apart, which is frankly a fairly onerous project because it would probably require kind of getting down to individual data, individual level data, and really understanding kind of specifically how those investments that have been made at a program level translated into specific activities. So this is, I would describe this, I guess, Representative New Brindley, as really trying to give a flavor of the way in which these programs aren't all doing the same thing. And so even though there's a lot of puzzle pieces on the board, what they're really doing is they're filling in gaps that other programs may not meet, but that may be essential to pair with other programs for the intervention that's being offered to be successful.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair.
And perhaps if in case just some of my state colleagues who operate those programs have more they'd want to add to that, I'd welcome any other comment from them, but otherwise I'm happy to turn back to you.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, seeing none, Representative Brindley, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And I can imagine that digging down is very granular. But I would reiterate what Representative Gomez said earlier. And I think it would be really interesting, and not just interesting, but really important to really grasp the scope of what we're doing to sort of cross-reference names in these different programs to see, okay, what kind of supports are, you know, the same person is obviously taking advantage of multiple supports to help them function. What does that look like? I think we almost need that picture to make good decisions going forward and help making sure that we're supporting folks in the best way. So thank you for that. That was helpful.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Ryer, I don't know if your hand's up from earlier, if you have another question.
I actually have, thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a different comment, not about the data so much as the message from it. I happened to be at a MICA breakfast this morning for my area, for MICA South, and Tony Schertler, who's the executive director of the Dakota County CDA, made the comment that rent assistance is the most effective way to help with the issues that we're facing. And I just appreciated then seeing it be, even with the services, the two sections, seeing how strongly that message from people in our regions on the ground were playing it out through our budgeting. So I just wanted to make that observation that aspect of it looks like a very strong allocation of services. And I also am interested in the whole individual data, and I'm just curious if the database that we talked about, that the federal one, I've gone blank on the name of it, will help be a tool for that. Is that part of the function of it? Thank you.
Chair Grumbel?
Chair Gomez and Representative Ryer, thank you for that question. I think really understanding the kind of relationship between program level investments down to the way that individual nonprofits or other organizations have braided funds or braided funding together to operate their programs, which includes funds that are not included in this analysis. It could include funding from local government or philanthropy or the federal government. That is a fairly massive data project to really be able to untangle all of that complexity. So I think just to be transparent about the fact that directly connecting kind of funds that are appropriated by the state to the activities is something that we have some visibility, but not perfect visibility into being able to depict. The other thing that's worth sharing is that I think in many ways, what you described, Representative Ryer, is very much the way that HMIS has been used to help us have the insight that we can, recognizing the limits and what's possible to know. It is not the system that's used for every single homeless intervention. Not every program receives state funding. Not every program is required to use the system. And in addition, there are programs that are really administered through our mainstream human service system that use different data systems. And so just to appreciate that the data landscape is about as complicated as the funding landscape when we really tease it out and delve into it. And I think HMIS in some ways is a common platform for many of those programs, but it's really important to note that it's not all of them. And again, I'd offer if my state colleagues have anything they want to add to that, give them a chance to weigh in.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yep, of course, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure that it's clear, Mr. Grimdahl, that I get what we're talking about in the complexity, and I'm not advocating for a giant new data matching project. So I just want to be clear about that. My question was really, to what extent does the HMIS get us there? And so I just wanted to clear that up so I didn't cause any anxiety or stress on about data. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. This feels stressful already. So, you know, that table stressed me out. So we're trying to keep it mellow here if we can. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Grumbel.
Thanks, Chair Gomez. And Representative Ryer, I will also confess to being a data geek, so I'm somebody that really does appreciate the weeds there. This is actually the last summary slide we had to present today, and so just would welcome any other questions or any other information that the chair or members would like to have us speak to today, especially while we have our team on standby.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that presentation, Mr. Grumdahl, and thanks to everybody for being here. I have a few questions. I guess kind of going back to what Representative Petersburg was asking, again, you know, I feel like we're sort of struggling with getting our arms around this problem, as I said. And I remember, I think I was talking to Assistant Commissioner Bomtrog about the rental assistance program, and he was telling me that, you know, some people would apply for it and it would be like they were 2 months behind on their electricity and like that was the thing and it was $300. And then some people were like 7 months behind on their rent and that's like, you know, $8,000. And at the time we were talking about the sort of administrative realities of that it sort of like takes the same administrative amount to like process the $300 claim as the $7,000 claim. But it occurred to me that as you know, as we were thinking, you know, Representative Petersburg's question about like, okay, so you look at each of these programs, like how many people are they serving? What's the sort of like overall kind of per capita investment or whatever, you know, that's sort of one of the ways that we just like think about how we spend money. And I don't know if I've talked very much about this in the committees yet, but like when you talk to people who are very experienced kind of like direct service providers. And this isn't like a perfect division, but there are certain people who, you know, who have been experiencing like chronic unsheltered homelessness for many years, many of whom have like significant challenges. I mean, you know, I think about Mr. Ford and the health challenges that he talked about, the mental health challenges, incarceration, you know, substance use disorder. He talked about all of those issues. And then there are people who certainly, like, you interact with or who you meet who are like, you know, their car broke down, so they lost their job, so they couldn't pay their rent. And so those are like different realities and sort of different levels of investment that are needed to like get a person to where they need to be able to like be stably housed. And that's to me one of the challenges here, right? Is that there are some people who like, again, who have very complex issues they're facing in their lives, who have encountered the failures of many of our systems throughout their lives. And sometimes generationally, people talk about the generational impacts of homelessness, that like if a person experiences homelessness with their family as a child, that they're more likely to experience it throughout their adult life, and then their children are more likely to experience it. And then like somebody who, you know, the minimum wage is $10 an hour, an apartment costs $1,400 plus utilities, and it's just kind of like the economics aren't adding up. I don't know if there's any, if that distinction is like useful to think about as we're thinking about this sort of question, or if there's, I don't know, if you have any comment kind of on that, because it's sort of just something that I've heard from a number of different providers as like a way to think about this. And it presents a challenge, I think, in the way that we maybe normally think about program investment on a per capita basis.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I would say in response, I think what you've named is really an important part of why the variety and diversity of responses that you've seen today are play important and distinct roles, complementary roles. I think the other thing that we are acutely aware of is that the nimbleness and creativity and resilience of people experiencing homelessness and the people that are supporting them really has been having that creativity and resilience and person level care lead the way is really an essential part of what we've seen be most successful. So rather than coming in with a kind of prepackaged answer of here's what everybody needs, to be able to actually have resources that are adaptable and service providers that are nimble and oriented in that way to be able to respond to needs as they vary over time. I think the success that we've seen in the work to end veteran homelessness has also demonstrated that the power of really being able to organize around the individual person and figure out what the right resources are for that person's needs as they evolve over time, but have it be really centered on the specific story, the specific situation, the specific opportunities that individual faces, as opposed to here's the thing we've got and this is what we give to everybody. And so I think that a lot of the complexity of this landscape is in part because advocates in arguing or adding, arguing to add these additional programs and services to the mix of what is available in Minnesota have recognized that we don't have a one-size-fits-all problem, and so we can't have a one-size-fits-all solution either.
Thank you for that. I saw that Representative New Brinley had her hand up. If you were kind of going to like ask about this topic, I would ask you to go ahead, but if you're going to introduce a new question, I had one more that I wanted to get to before we move on.
It is about this, so I appreciate that.
Great. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate that observation. I think we all are sort of thinking along those same lines. And I think it gets down to the question of, with this division specifically and our charge here, who are we? Who are we trying to help? And who can we most effectively do that for? And I know, you know, Madam Chair, we talked about that prior to session starting. As sort of a priority of mine, that I think that, you know, there are so many different populations. There are so many things that wrap into this. How do we prioritize and who are we really trying to help, and who can we effectively help through the work in this division? And I guess I would ask that, Madam Chair, as sort of a follow-up question and I don't know if there's a good answer to that, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
To hear my thoughts on it?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, totally. Great. Well, I'm glad that you asked, because since we had our conversation, you know, I have been thinking a lot about that, you know, about the realities of existing in the context of, you know, like limited resources, the context as Representative Petersburg keeps kind of pointing us to, of like so many of these interventions being really downstream and us like needing to think kind of more upstream potentially, if we are actually talking about preventing homelessness, although we're kind of always doing both of these things, right? Because we have to have a response to folks who are already there, but we also have to be doing our other work with an eye toward understanding those circumstances and situations that lead people to this place, and how it is that we can intervene and make sure that fewer and fewer of our neighbors in Minnesota are getting to that place. And so I'm working on a bill about ending children's homelessness in Minnesota. That's what I think we need to do. That's what I think, you know, I looked at the Homework Starts with Home program. And if you think about the cost to our society of allowing a child to not have a place to lay their head at night, the cost to schools, the cost, I mean, even just like, you know, when you talk to schools about serving, because there's the Federal Homeless Children's Act. I don't know the name of it. I'm really bad at this stuff. But you have to keep kids in their home school. And so just the transportation costs that, like, that a district takes on when a kid's moving around and they're having to, like, Uber them to school or whatever. If you talk to your local schools, you know, they likely are dealing with this issue. So to me, like, I'm going to have the veterans, the Minnesota VA come in and talk to us about the incredible work that they've been doing in really like doing exactly what you say, Representative Brindley, in saying like, here's a population that we know is really impacted and that we can really make a difference on. I mean, the difference, of course, with the veterans' homelessness is that they have these federal housing assistance vouchers. And so, you know, we do obviously, you know, as we saw, there's 6.3, I think, million new investment in the ending veterans homelessness out of the Minnesota General Fund. So we are augmenting it, but there is that sort of base of funding there. But personally, I mean, like I've kind of been thinking about this idea, you know, for a couple of years now, ever since I learned about the incredible impact that it has on my school district, you know, to serve so many homeless and highly mobile students. Like in Minneapolis, I think it's like, it's 9 to 11% is what they normally say, which is just, you know, and then in certain schools, it's 30%, right? So, you know, as we talk about the sort of externalities, right? What are the costs? What are the human costs? And what are the actual material costs to our public budgets of allowing people to be homeless? And what are the sort of ethical and moral obligations that we have to people in our state? Personally, I think that us coming together and saying, you know what, it's too important for children to have a roof over their heads. And we are going to come together as Minnesotans, regardless of our ideology, because guess what? We all love our kids. We all see what this is doing to our state budgets. We see what it's doing to families. We see what it's doing to communities. And that, you know, we live in a place where we can really, you know, marshal the resources to put into that issue. So that's my opinion. I would love to hear your opinion about it too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Madam Chair, I do really appreciate that. And we had that exact conversation. Like, it seems like helping our children and trying to prevent homelessness among children in the state of Minnesota should be a high priority for us. You know, it's just complex when we think about this committee in particular, because some things are simple math, right? I mean, if what we're trying to do is house the homeless population, well, we've got a homeless population times the number of housing units needed. It's math to get there. But I know that there's so much more to it. And so, you know, I mean, are we trying to house people? Are we trying to sort of cushion the ups and downs of life, and how to help manage those things? They're different things, but it seems like in this committee, you know, by definition, if we're working on preventing homelessness, we're looking at helping people who are not in fact homeless yet. And I know that a lot of the wraparound services are exactly designed to help those populations sort of remain housed. So I appreciate what you said. I think that there is a lot of value in us sort of targeting specific populations and figuring out what impact we can have on those populations. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. We have a few minutes left. I don't know if anybody else had anything they wanted to add or any further questions, Vice Chair Keeler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just to kind of follow up on the preventing homelessness conversation, and funding is one thing, but I think it's a lens. I think it's a lens that we have to put on every conversation. Like when we talk about food insecurities and food shelters and being able to register kids for school and how we're allowing our youth to transition to professionals, then it's a lens. Like it's a lens that whatever committees we're on, whatever conversations we're in, it's really being mindful in how can this impact or how can this change people's outcome in their life. I know people kind of like to ask, like, well, was there one thing in your life that happened that changed your path and now has made you homeless? We know that there's multiple things that happen. And so I guess for me, I would just encourage us all to really think about when we're in those spaces, now that we've learned so much and we've heard so many people's stories, and that, you know, that's this wide variety, that if we all can have a lens of the possibility that maybe we need to speak up to say, you know, we need to invest a little bit more in some of those other areas too. It's not just out of this pocket of money. That's what I would say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Keeler. Representative Hollins?
Well, I raised my hand, and I think that Vice Chair Keeler really said what I was going to say, and that is that, you know, also that homelessness is not, and housing is not static, right? Like, it's something that goes up and down, and you can have it at one point and lose it again. And I think that, you know, we have to really be thinking about this in a way that's systemic and that's meaningful, and that, you know, obviously we want everybody to have housing, and we want to have these safety nets to prevent homelessness, but it's something that is going to constantly be in flux, and there are going to be new difficulties that arise repeatedly. I mean, nobody could have predicted COVID-19, right? Nobody could have predicted how this would have this tremendous impact. And I think that, you know, that's what's really great about this committee, is that forward thinking aspect of it. And so, yeah, I'm just basically seconding what Vice Chair Keeler said. Sorry, I'll stop talking.
No, that's great. Thank you so much, Representative Hollins. And you kind of said sort of one of the things that I was thinking that I wanted to say as we're wrapping up here, that actually that our CA just kind of texted to me, which is like that homelessness isn't like a static state, right? It's not like once somebody is homeless, then they are doomed to be homeless forever. People, you know, mostly, and you talk to folks, even people who we kind of talk about as like chronically unsheltered, like have housing periodically in different kind of formations. And so, you know, even as we talk about targeting our investments where they're most needed, and where can we make the best interventions, and how can we work to prevent this from happening to begin with, you know, it's so important that we recognize that, like, preventing homelessness means preventing currently homeless people from being homeless moving forward. preventing homelessness means preventing people who were previously homelessness and are now precariously housed from falling back into homelessness. And so it's sort of, it's one of these things where it has to be our solutions in this area are yes and solutions, because people are individuals and are, you know, as we've heard from so many testifiers, are in their own kind of places, and we need to meet them where they are, because all people deserve access to affordable and dignified housing. And with that, it's 12 o'clock. I'm so thankful for this conversation today and for everybody coming here with curiosity and openness. I feel like we're learning together, and we're going to continue to do this work and again to work to develop a shared understanding of this really complicated issue so that we can figure out most effectively how to move forward together. My gratitude to you all, and have a great weekend. With that, we are adjourned.